Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy. While Britain's headlines are dominated by the race to lead the Conservative Party, the opposition Labour Party, led by Jeremy Corbyn, is locked in its own identity struggle. At a fractious shadow cabinet meeting on Tuesday, the top brass again failed to agree on how to resolve the Brexit stalemate. It's a lack of clarity that's cost the party dearly. After losing about half of its representatives in the European elections, Labour has plummeted to just 20% in the polls, tying with the Conservatives behind the new Brexit party on 23%. My guest today is John McDonnell, Shadow Chancellor, and the second half of the duumvirate that's taken Labour decisively to the left. He's a self-proclaimed Marxist who lists among his hobbies fomenting the overthrow of capitalism. Well, when he's not up to that, he's representing a West London constituency of Hayes and Harlington. He's done that for over 20 years. McDonnell became one of the strongest voices in Labour calling for a second referendum. He argues it should campaign for Remain, but Jeremy Corbyn insists he needs more time to make the final call, 2 more weeks of consultation. So this week we're asking, can Labour solve its Brexit problem? John McDonnell, welcome to The Economist Asks.
Hi, thanks for inviting me in.
How long have you been reading The Economist? I gather you have a dog-eared collection at home.
I think it's about 45 years. So what was that? Yeah, mid-20s, I suppose, yeah.
And was that part of a desire to engage? I mean, at that point, your politics were already pretty much the far left. Yeah, The Economist, not so much part of the great liberal tradition. Were you trying to find out what the enemy thinks?
Partly because I was a student. That's the first thing. So, you know, you get recommended reading when you're a student. The Economist is one of those things. But also, yeah, it was about making sure you get a broader view of what's going on the ground, definitely. And a competing view as well.
So speaking of competing views, let's go into the situation that faces us at the moment very seriously in the country as a whole over Brexit. And despite your prediction of white smoke at the shadow cabinet earlier this week, Labour's top team has failed to reach an agreement on whether there should be a second referendum, or indeed, if so, what the concrete terms of that would be. What went wrong?
I won't talk about what happened in Shadow Cabinet because they're meant to be confidential, although there seem to be various leaks that have taken place, most of them out of context, but there you are. What Jeremy reported is that the unions want a bit more time in the discussion, so a few more weeks, which is fair enough, and also further discussion with NEC members. So this is the nature of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, which I support, the whole style of it, which is consensus building, trying to make sure you listen to everyone's point of view and then try and bring people around to an agreement. And then once we're taking that decision, that's it. We adhere to it. And I think that's what Jeremy's argument
but
was.
But it sounded to me like you thought more would happen this week and that you actively yourself.
Yeah.
And I know not everything that is said of shadow cabinet meetings is true, but there does seem a fairly consistent account that you spoke strongly in favour of getting on with it. And there is even a report that you described the Brexit policy of your party as a slow-moving car crash.
I'm not going to comment on what was said in the shadow cabinet.
Did you say it?
I'm not going to comment on that. But the position is exactly as Jeremy has said. We thought we'd have a clear view by yesterday. The unions want more time, which is fair enough, and they've got to consult their own members as well and different structures that they've got. So I was arguing basically consistently in the public now that we do need to come to a view, and that needs to be sooner rather than later. And I'd much rather that was done before we had a new prime minister, and in that way our position would be absolutely clear.
But you had a long time to come to this position. Is the disagreement fundamentally a philosophical one that Jeremy Corbyn and some people close to him and Len McCluskey, a leading trade unionist in this equation, have doubts about the idea of going back to the people, fundamentally taking the view that you've had a big referendum.
Let's go through it step by step. Because, again, this isn't betraying confidence from Shadow Cabinet. This is the discussion that's gone on
publicly. You can always do that if you feel it.
Well, I won't. Step by step, I think there's unanimity about opposing no deal. That's the first thing. And unanimity across the movement, but also unanimity with our partners in industry, if you like. Yesterday we met with the CBI, the Institute of Directors, Federation of Small Businesses, the Chamber, and to an organisation they're opposed to a no deal. So that's where we're at. Second thing is then, how do we oppose that effectively? The general view now, and I think that virtual unanimity, is to go back to the people in a public vote. Now, some people are saying, yes, we need a general election. Of course we do. But the reality is it's a public vote through a referendum.
So you think just on a timeline, I'm sorry, let you continue, but there's the aim of a general election, which was the primary Labour policy.
And always will be. And always will be.
Well, the opposition, of course you'd like an election. Yeah. But you now think that a referendum is more likely in terms of
it's a judgment.
The time.
It's a judgment. Others think actually it's more difficult to get a referendum than it is a general election.
What do you think?
I think it's most probably easier to get Conservative MPs to vote for a referendum than it is for a general election. But, here's the but, in terms of parliamentary procedure, it's easier to go for a no confidence vote than it is to get an agreement to a referendum. So that's the rub that we're in at the moment. And somehow we've got to work our way through this. And it isn't just us. It's the other political parties, and also it's a significant number of Conservative MPs as well, because they equally oppose a no deal. Now, you saw what Tobias Elwood said the other day. He's willing to vote in a no-confidence motion if necessary to bring about a general election. So a lot of this is about tactics. So if I get absolutely clear, we're opposed to a no deal. Jeremy's made it clear any deal or a no deal needs to go back to the people for a public vote. Of course, we want a general election if we can, but a public vote in this instance means a referendum. So then the other issue to be decided is what, because you always get the next question, if you're having a public vote, what's your attitude? What's your position on all of this?
Exactly.
So that's the next stage of the debate, and that's the consultation that's going on. I've said publicly what my personal position is that if there's another referendum, I've got to be honest with people, I'd vote for Remain, and I'd campaign for Remain. Now, but we've got to arrive at a party position on that we can adhere to, and that's
the
discussion.
Do you think Jeremy Corbyn would vote for Remain in another referendum in all circumstances? Would Jeremy Corbyn vote
for Remain? I can't speak for him, because he's in a position now where he's trying to make
sure... He's your leader.
Yes, I know, but he has to speak for himself. And what he's trying to do is bring people together to... And this is what's great about Jeremy Corbyn. He's a different type of leader. He's a consensus builder. He's a person who brings people together. And then once a decision is made, that's it. We adhere to it.
Is your own position revoke or second referendum? You said you would support it.
Second referendum, I think, is more acceptable to people. I think people want a say. And I've been talking to all sides. I've been talking to the People's Vote campaign. You know, I've been in discussions with Alistair Campbell and others and the members of the People's Vote campaign. And their principal position is go back to the people. Now, I know others want to get Parliament to decide to revoke, but I think the thing that will gain most support is going back to the people.
And just on revoke, that is actually an option which seems somewhat more popular at the moment, if you look at the polling, than second referendum, where people aren't so sure what they're going to be asked. Would you consider backing revoke in any circumstances, or are you very fully allied now to the second?
Not addressing it. I'm trying to concentrate on this issue about work, step by step. How do we block no deal? How do we go back to the people? What mechanism can we devise on that? And then the discussion about the Labour's position.
You mentioned Alistair Campbell, former strategist under Tony Blair. Not your flavour of the Labour Party, really.
We talk. We talk about football mainly, but we talk.
You got kicked out of the party, didn't he, recently for saying he voted Liberal Democrat. Do you talk about that?
He's appealed.
Do you think he should have been stripped of his party membership for voting in a European election?
I can't comment on an individual case while his appeal is going on or his appeal is started or anything like that. My general view on all of these things now is to recognise that actually on Brexit has become a bit of a special issue. And there are large numbers of people who have voted for different parties solely on the basis of that issue, on the matter of principle.
So you might be a bit tolerant.
Well, we should respect that, I think. We should respect that and understand that and take that into account. The auto-exclusion upon which Alistair was thrown out of the pot, was actually introduced under New Labour. And I've never thought that was the right procedure.
What goes around comes around. So you would welcome Alistair Campbell back into the Labour family?
I always want to recruit to the Labour Party.
There is a split, really, isn't there, within the shadow cabinet? To what extent is it philosophical? Or is it just practical? Or we've got all these leave seats, we've got these trade unionists, some of whom are leave, some of whom are remain. For some people, and I get the impression that it is the case for Jeremy Corbyn, I think he finds it genuinely difficult to get up and say, I would like a second referendum in all circumstances and I would campaign to remain, because he has a Eurosceptic background.
No, I don't believe that's true, because he's said it enough times now. He's repeated it time and time again that we need to go back to the people on the basis of any deal or no deal. And I think that's he's said that enough times. So I doubt your judgment on that one. The issue in the debate, we believe that whatever structures that exist within Europe itself, whether it's the EU or alternative structures or whatever, will always work on a cross transnational basis for progressive causes. The issue is, the judgment within the party is, was the EU the appropriate structure? The conclusion we reached is, yes, it is, but there needs to be a lot of elements of reform. We didn't really have that debate before the referendum. That was part of the problem. Some ways, we're having a more rational debate now than we were before the referendum, and that's the tragedy of it all.
Could that really be the case? I think you're reported as saying you don't want another summer like the last one and the one before, and you don't want to see another leadership contest. Do you think that's a danger for the party this summer?
No, it isn't. There's no evidence of that. But the issue around the summer, the point I always made, I made this publicly, is that we're in a situation now where it is better to resolve our positioning on all these issues. One, before there's a new prime minister, that's the first thing, because we might well be
called. So by the last week.
Yeah, and we might well be called into negotiations with a new prime minister again, as we were last time. So that's important. The second issue is that we don't want to be in a situation where different competing sides within the party are campaigning all the way through the summer, not knowing what the party's position is.
And do you think the position will be Labour will campaign to remain?
No, that's my argument, and we'll see where we go from here.
So no danger of leadership turmoil?
No.
Would you want to be leader if the ball came from the back of the scrum, as Boris Johnson once put?
I tried to be leader twice, can you remember? I couldn't even get on the ballot paper. That's how popular I was. So there's no
times
chance.
Times have changed.
No. Jeremy's the leader for us, and he's the right leader for us. The issue for us now is not about leadership challenges or anything like that. The issue is we could be faced with a general election in October, and there's a seriousness within the Parliamentary Labour Party and the movement overall to get ready for that, both in campaigning but also in policy terms.
Would you hold a no confidence vote when a Tory leader had just been elected, which is obviously Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt, or would you think your responsibility as the opposition is to try and support an outcome before you do that? You've sometimes signalled that you want to bring down this government immediately, and sometimes you want to work with them.
We'll make the call. We'll make the call dependent on the statements made by the new Prime Minister. And so far, if it is, as far as I can see, the sort of reckless drive towards a no deal, I think the call will be we've got to end this as quickly as we possibly can. That, if that will use every mechanism then to either bring about a referendum or a general election. But we'll see what comes out of
What do you make of Boris Johnson, a sort of slightly populist tone that Boris Johnson is almost a kind of balance that's left populism, which you set in motion with the Momentum movement?
No, I don't accept that. I think
Do you admire him?
No. I think he's completely reckless. I think he's dangerous. And I think his behaviour at times is unacceptable.
Have you spoken to him?
I speak to him because he's my next door neighbour constituency MP. But I'll just give the example of where I feel personally let down. If you remember, we were running the Third Runway campaign. And it was me at the count said to him, you know, will you honour the promise that his predecessor of lying down in front of the bulldozers? Because Boris says, oh, yes, I'll be there with you, John, and all this. And then when it comes to the vote on the night of the House of Commons, he leaves the country.
Politicians, huh? Green Industrial Revolution. You spoke this week to the trade body UK Finance. You laid out your plan for a Green Industrial Revolution, including delisting companies with poor green credentials from the stock exchange in London. Now, there's been a mixed reaction, it'd be fair to say, in the city to this. Financial totalitarianism, a command economy. How on earth do you win over big business to your plans, which sound very constraining to them?
Talking to them directly rather than reading the headlines in some of our more fiction-oriented newspapers, I think. What I laid out in my speech, and I have done for a series of speeches, is that what we want to do is harness the resources and the effectiveness of our finance sector in the city. We've already published reports about how can we mobilise the finance sector more effectively. At the moment, the productive side of our economy is creating wealth, it's going into the city, and then largely it's been invested in property speculation. How can we harness that more effectively to make sure we attract inward investment? Because to run alongside the state investment, but there has to be a clear view about what the priorities are. And at the moment, we set our priorities out as tackling the climate change, fourth industrial revolution, and tackling regional imbalances.
But if you're an investor coming into the UK and you've got a Labour government, John McDonnell as Chancellor, instead of Shadow Chancellor, you're bringing money into this country, you're being told in no uncertain terms that the word harnessed is applied to you a number of times. You've also seen in your nationalisation strategy that you think it is okay to visit nationalisation on companies, and you have not been absolutely clear about their compensation. So it sounds like a bit of a difficult bet for any investor to make.
Let's go through that then, because the most important thing is that actually we're completely open and transparent about what we do, so people know what we're going to do. They know what they're going to get when they get Labour government, when we go into power. So the whole process I'm going through now and have done for the last 18 months is explaining these are our objectives, these are those policies. Actually, if you disagree with some of those policies but agree at the objectives, you tell me an alternative and we'll look at that in detail, which we are doing. But in addition to that, this is the limit of what we're doing. So what you see is what you get. I do this
thing. But they don't have to come here, right? Capital is very mobile.
No, that's true. But that, but
does that not worry
what they'll also see is a government that's willing to invest state resources alongside private sector resources where they'll get a good rate of return in a growing economy. There'll be investment opportunities under us that they've never had, certainly under this government, over the last 9 years to a decade. We're talking about, you know, the scale of our ambition is enormous, and tackling climate change, it has to be. So barrages all the way around the country in our coastal towns, alternative energy sources, wind power, wave power, and that alternative energy will have to be constructed. And there's the opportunities around carbon capture, for example, huge, immense opportunities for investment. And I think actually investors will be excited by that.
You've said capital controls aren't going to happen.
No.
But why not? If you want to constrain the amount of money in the country...
There's no need, because there won't be capital flight. People will want to invest in this country. They will. They'll see the opportunity of a growing economy to invest in. They'll get a decent rate of return. We're not going to be ripped off anymore. They'll get a decent rate of return. And this is what I keep saying. This is why I meet the CBI and the Institute of Directors. We want them coming into government with us. So yesterday, when we met the Big Five, which are the business associations, we said to them, I've asked them to prepare a report about how they would like to come into government with us, what existing structures work, what don't, but what sort of structures would they like? And I'll just give you one example. They say at the moment, a real breakthrough of the last 12 months is that the business secretary is calling them in for a regular meet. I said, that will continue. They said, and number 10 is now consulting. I said, that will continue. You tell us what structures you want, because I want you alongside us in advising us and making these decisions.
Mm. You've been to nice school, haven't you? You sat making it sound very nice.
I've always been
very
nice.
Very cooperative.
I've always been nice. My mum always said, be kind, and that's what I try and be. Don't always succeed, I admit.
It's a rough and tumble game, politics.
It doesn't have to be.
You found battle on sort of revolutionary turf for many years.
You win the argument. That's the whole point.
You were fermenting the overthrow of capitalism. Are you getting there?
Well, I think I'm transforming it and I'm winning the argument. The whole point is actually you ensure that people understand your policies are just common sense. And at the moment, if you look at the polling on most of our policies, overwhelming support.
That will be tested at some point.
Soon,
you hope. Although, in fact, do you think the second referendum more likely than general election?
I've said that it's very difficult to see the Tories voting for a general election, but then Tobias Elwood came out and said he would, so the game might change.
On nationalisation, you and Labour generally have pointed to the example of Northern Rock. That's a British bank that became insolvent at the height of the financial crisis and was taken into public ownership. Shareholders lost their claim for compensation. There's still a lot of other companies and banks wrangling about what they were charged at Credit Suisse in a case this week. Now, your nationalisation plans do seem to sort of rely on that kind of precedent, that the government can basically take control and that the compensation is unclear. Why is that fair?
I think Northern Rock was a special case. It's interesting. I think I was the first MP to raise Northern Rock in the middle of the crisis. And at that point, I was the first MP who said, actually, you're going to have to nationalise to stabilise the system. And Alistair Darling was the Chancellor then, and initially resisted and then eventually happened. Alistair had a bit of a... He's got a good sense of humour. So when I got up again and said, actually, I advised you to nationalise and now you have, he said, well, you've been calling for that for 30 years anyway. You're bound to be right sometime. So the issue for me is to follow the past trend of nationalisations where Parliament will determine the price and the level of compensation, but people will be protected. They'll get government bonds in return.
They get government bonds in return. It depends how the government performs, doesn't it?
Well, if we've got a growing economy under Labour, it'll perform very well.
Well, that's the big
issue. The key issue for a lot of people as well is making sure that they get a stable rate of return for their investment.
You have a proposal on a share ownership, a proposal to transfer 10% of share ownership to employees. Some criticisms that we raised about that. One was having shares in the same company that pays your salary isn't always a great thing. Ask Enron employees. Yeah. How would you protect against that? And the other one, which I have returned to, but I think this is another good example, is a disregard for property rights. This would be imposed on employers without their so-so. Some called it an expropriation of shareholder wealth.
Let's deal with the Enron issue. Mm-hmm. First of all, this will be on top of your normal salary. So it's a bonus as much as anything. So what you're having is 1% of the shares of that company, larger companies, above 250 employees. 1% a year transferred over a period of 10 years into collective ownership. Those shares will be managed. It will obviously give you shareholder rights as well. So it will be done collectively. So it will be in addition to your salary. There's no greater risk than that because your salary will be at risk if something went broke anyway. That's the first thing. The second thing is, look, for 40 years, most people have argued and signed up to the whole concept of a stakeholder economy. And for those 40 years, Will Hutton has written extensively on this. And I think some of the work he's done has been brilliant. But it hasn't happened. So on a voluntary basis, this idea of this stakeholder economy hasn't been created. So we've said now we'll move to a mandatory form of that. Now, it's interesting. I met with the CBI yesterday. They've done some research, I think, with the city. They're going to send me about the scale of voluntary employee ownership schemes. And I'll have a look at that research. Of course I will, because I've said time and time again, this is our objective. If you can find me another way through, fair enough, I'll look at that. But at the moment, voluntary exhortation for 40 years hasn't worked.
I've got to ask you, if foreign-owned firms or multinationals with small, relatively small number of employees in the UK then just said, well, I don't much fancy your not-quite-voluntary scheme, what would prevent them just moving elsewhere?
Well, it's interesting. I think most of them, if you look at quite a few of them, they've got voluntary participation in shareholding in that way anyway. But I think we can convince them. The reason we can convince them is all the evidence shows the more employee participation and ownership, the longer-term decision-making takes place and the higher levels of productivity.
We've had a bit of a suppressed assumption in this conversation that it's Labour versus the Tories, same as it ever was.
Anything
since you came into politics and started reading The Economist a long time ago. But it really, the Brexit Party, there are other disruptive forces. How much do you worry about politics changing sort of out of the control of the old two-party structures, and particularly the Brexit Party and Nigel Farage eating your lunch electorally?
I think it's a one-off. We'll see. I never ever dismiss the opposition, and you need to take it into account. I think it's a bit like UKIP, though. I think it's like a desert flower. It will bloom and die back once the issue is resolved.
Like a desert flower. Mm-hmm. It will bloom and die back. That's a description of Nigel Farage that is going to linger in the mind.
It is, really. Maybe a prickly flower.
Do you have any admiration for that disruptive revolutionary energy,
or
do you think it's dangerous?
It's easy to pander to xenophobia and issues like that. That's the easiest form of politics, and that's why it's so dangerous, but also that's why also it's got to be opposed.
Another form of xenophobia has haunted the party under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and yours at the top of it is anti-Semitism. Mm. You've said we weren't fast enough, we weren't ruthless enough, and I'm quite angry about what has happened. And yet, There are still well-researched stories saying that the party has not responded quickly, adequately, that cases of alleged anti-Semitism of leading members, officials, candidates sort of don't get dealt with any speed or ruthlessness, to take your word. Why not?
I think initially, initially, to be frank, the bureaucracy wasn't under our control. That's the first thing. That has to be admitted. Once we got that under control and brought in a new general secretary, brought in what we'd been arguing, what Shami Chakrabarty had been arguing for ages, which is proper legal advice. So we got a QC, a very good barrister involved, and a legal panel. Things stepped up and improved. But now we've got the EHRC investigation. I welcome that.
But because, hang on a minute. I mean, why is this happening? Why has it gone on so long? It has to be a bit more than, like, we couldn't get hold of the QC in time and we didn't have the bureaucracy.
There's an element of the organisation was poor to deal with it, and I think we resolved that. The second is this issue, I think we don't think we were ruthless enough about it, and, you know, that's... In the Labour Party, I think people want to go that extra mile. Sometimes you have to put your foot down and say, that's it. But now the commission is involved. I think this is a great thing. They can then tell us what we've done right, what we've done wrong. Hopefully we'll get a clean bill of health. If we don't, I want the recommendations that they put to us implemented.
But don't you worry. You know, for someone who's intellectually sort of curious about lots of things, you don't seem to worry too much about where this comes from.
Oh, I do.
No,
you've got that wrong.
Right.
Look, hang on. No, the lessons we've got to learn. I met with a number of Jewish organisations over the last couple of weeks. I met with a group of young Jewish people from America and from Britain. And what they've done, which is absolutely brilliant, is they've produced a booklet now just to educate people about the nature of anti-Semitism. Now, we always prided ourselves on being an anti-racist party. And I think we prided ourselves as well in our society that we may well have overcome anti-Semitism. We haven't. And our society is still plagued by it.
Why is it virulent on the left? Is it?
I don't think it is.
Hang on. Let me ask the question.
It isn't virulent.
Is it always just a sort of series of unfortunate anti-Semitic events?
No, it isn't.
Or is it somehow linked to the ideology and attention?
I don't accept that.
Really goes back to the time of Marx.
No,
so in many ways you admire.
I do. Well, Marx was a Jew himself. He was a son of a rabbi.
Yeah, he also had great tensions.
But look, let's go back to it. No, it isn't on the left. If you look at all the surveys, actually, the propensity of anti-Semitism is on the right. But that doesn't matter. It does not matter where it is. We've got to eradicate it. And I made this point about, you know, the figures in the Labour Party, 0.01% or whatever. It doesn't matter. If there's one anti-Semite in our name, it doesn't matter. We've got to resolve
it. It is linked to a view on the left of the foundation of Israel.
I'm sorry, it goes further back than that. If we think it's just that, we're wrong. We misunderstand it. We've got to accept that anti-Semitism goes back in our society, even to the medieval period. And it's gone on and on in different waves and different forms as well. Now, we prided ourselves, I think, complacently, thinking we'd eradicated it within our society. And we haven't. It's there. So we get to a situation now where the lack of education, the language that is used sometimes, and this is what I thought was really brilliant about the different groups I've been meeting, they're saying what we need to do now is have a comprehensive education program, not just in the Labour Party, but more generally about the language we use, the understanding of anti-Semitism, the recognition it's so deep-rooted within our society still, and that we have to have mechanisms for overcoming. And again,
for many of those who are active and who have pushed an agenda which many see as anti-Semitic, it is to do with the view of Israel, it is to do with the view what they would call anti-Zionist.
No, I'm sorry, I disagree with that. But
it's all over.
There are some.
All over social media, every day of the week.
No, there are some anti-Semites who will use Israel as to promote their anti-Semitism, and they will use the behaviour of the Netanyahu government in particular to use that. And that's part of the education process. We've got to demonstrate to people that that is a mechanism that anti-Semites use and that we've got to counter. Of course we can.
So Israel, just to be very clear, in your view, John, has a right to exist
as it
was set up.
Of course it does. For years I was nominated for parliamentary selections by Pole Zion, the Jewish organisation within our party. Of course it has a right to exist, but just as every Israeli will tell you, they have the right, as everyone else has, to criticise a particular government's behaviour, particularly if they think it is impacting upon other people's human rights. And you cannot allow people to be divided in this way. And that's why anti-Semites use Israelis' behaviour to promote their anti-Semitism. part of the education we've got to do is allow people to understand how you distinguish that.
And do you think many prominent figures in your party, including yourself, including Jeremy Corbyn, have been careful enough with the company they kept, often on platforms, often in your, when you're campaigning, in your radical days? I don't want to say just your badge-wearing days, but the days when you were counter, sort of culturally,
yeah,
politically.
2 points.
That you were not careful enough about the company that you kept among those who had doubts about Israel's right to exist, or indeed have been accused of anti-Semitism.
The company you keep sometimes is about, well, first of all, my radical days aren't over. My radical days are here. That's the first thing. The second thing is the company you keep often is about the people you need to speak to get them around tables at times. And that's part of the challenge that you always have as a politician.
Speaking of the company you keep, we went off to the RMT Union's garden party for Cuba.
Yes.
A jolly sounding affair. The more serious point about that, this is the kind of event you still like to turn up at. You've said a Labour government would be the country's staunchest ally to support the Cuban revolution. Cuban revolution has not been an unalloyed blessing for the people of Cuba, has it?
I think it's enhanced the quality of life of the Cuban people immensely, both in terms of education and health and the quality of their life overall. There have been issues or criticisms, of course there are, and I've made those criticisms. I think it's time now for other states to be supporting the Cuban people rather than instigating blockades and boycotts, etc., which undermines the quality of life of those people.
The alliances sound a bit like they're stuck in a Cold War.
No, not at
Cuba,
all.
Cuba, a bit soft on Russia?
Quite the reverse. I'm trying to pull the world out of those Cold War attitudes to say you shouldn't be blockading countries like Cuba. You should be inviting them around the table, particularly economically.
Last question. Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who would get your vote?
Bernie Sanders.
You're a Sanders. Sanders through and through. John McDonnell, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you.
And we want to hear what you think. Is Labour right to back a second referendum? Should Remain be an option on that ballot paper? And has John McDonnell's party acted forcefully enough on anti-Semitism? Write to us at radio@economist.com, or you can tweet us at Economist Radio. And if you're not yet a subscriber, you can go to economist.com/radio offer and you'll get your first 12 issues for £12 or $12. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.